a yo-yo?
If you wish to give me a present?
I'd like to be a dentist.
Okay, so you're hearing this, and you know by now you're listening to the Christmas Specials We Love podcast, and you have to know, at least by hearing this, if you're a true fan of our show and, of course, Christmas Specials, this is one of the greatest of all times. This is a Charlie Brown Christmas, of course, the theme. But, Kelsey, may I ask if you could now bring in Lucy and Linus, or Linus and Lucy, the other iconic theme song that's used in this, but then in future Peanuts episodes,
you got only because it.
I feel like I need my energy to come up, bringing me down a little bit. I'm here with Ann, with Christian, with Evan. Evan representing Gen Z. Kelsey's got millennials covered. And then we are lost between Boomer and Gen X. We're part of the lost generation, Christian, Ann, and myself. There we
Absolutely.
Go. You know, it's funny doing this. Ann and I were just talking about how this is a half-hour episode. We're like, okay, it'll be pretty quick, pretty easy breezy. But what come to learn it, much like the world of Rankin Bass, there's a whole world of Peanuts and Charles Schulz, and there's just a lot attached to this. So I'm going to just get right into it. I'll give you a little background on Charles Schulz, a little background on the production history, and then we'll take it scene by scene. But I guess before I start, just my general thoughts is I saw this in a different way, I'll admit, that in the last 10 years, this is not in my traditional thing. My traditional cue, so to speak, is Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Year Without a Santa Claus, Rudolph, Frosty, It's a Wonderful Life, Alistair Sim Scrooge. And, you know, this one, I don't know, I have to go by my wife and, you know, just, I think I just never showed her this, so maybe it never hit our cue. But I will say, seeing this all these years later, I had a much different take on it. And I'll get into what that take is, but much, much different take. And what did you think?
Oh, I was so hoping you shared your take, Kev, because I've been kind of dreading the general thoughts. Like you, I don't watch this one every year. I have a similar list, like Wonderful Life is always a Christmas Day, Year Without a Santa Claus, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, and then a few others. Elf has been added to that. But this one, even as a little kid, even though I love Peanuts, like I don't want to, you know, hate on Peanuts. This one, the opening song, I find a little downtrodden.
Yeah.
Not a big jazz fan, so I didn't like the most of the soundtrack. And it maybe my sister had the like read along with the album, so maybe it's because she played it all the time. But not, I feel like I'm in confession, not one of my favorites, Kev. But like you, watching it again after doing the research and appreciating like all that went into it, I liked it a little better, but
okay.
Same.
Okay. All right. Yeah. For me. Okay. So I'll tease. I really thought it was beautiful. I loved it. And I saw it in a very different way, especially doing the research on him. But okay. Yeah. Christian, we'll go to you. We'll keep it with the lost generation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thoughts? And, you know, some folks say that Ann Sleeman's heart shrank three sizes. Oh, that that's a terrible thing to hear. I love this special. I have my own list. My list is a little bit non-traditional. It includes Muppet Family Christmas, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. And this one, when you asked if I could be on the show, it was a quick yes because I've seen it twice this Christmas season. I watch it every year with my kids.
Okay.
They love this one because it's a little shorter. My daughter's name is Lucy, so there's someone she identifies with immediately in the show. So I think that it's very sweet. I'm surprised that it is as religious as it is towards
yes.
the
Yes, yes. And that, this is what I, and, yeah. Yeah.
And yet it remained on
and they haven't
television
canceled
until
it.
Just a couple years ago.
Right. Until they haven't gotten rid of it based on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it surprises me that it's still out. It's still as popular as it is, despite the fact that it definitely leans in and has a point of view
not
on the religion.
it's not the best of the Peanuts specials in the sense that the characters are not figured out at this point. There's no Peppermint Patty. There's no Marcy. You don't have Franklin. And Woodstock's not even around yet.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no, it truly is the pilot. And we'll get into that. It's the pilot. Yeah. Okay, Kels, let's go to Millennial. Let's check in. I know these aren't very popular with the youth. What are you thinking?
This was my favorite special we've watched yet.
Come on.
Yeah.
I swear I loved it. I was laughing out loud. Mm-hmm. I take back every bad thing I've ever said about Lucy. I loved her in this. It was amazing. Sally asking Santa for $20 bills is me. I'm obsessed.
See? Oh my.
Tens and 20s.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, but I think that there was so much stuff here. Schultz was so far freaking ahead because other than the strong point of view with religion, everything else was like, oh my God, he is such a great writer and a great artist. The great writers can see what we don't see. He saw all of this coming, all of it.
Crazy progressive.
Yeah, because progressive in the sense of, like, I know the term today really stands for something specific, but I'm going to give you the generic term of progressive, meaning just so far ahead. Because remember, this was 1965. Like, so commercialism of Christmas, it was kind of a thing, but it really became 70s, 80s, 90s. Like, because this was still a time where Christmas was celebrated for a week. It wasn't like now where November 1st, it's on. And I don't want to get ahead. Okay, Evan, I'm excited to go to weigh in on Gen Z. Gen Z thoughts on A Charlie Brown Christmas. General thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can. I think I have too much to attach to this to like say if it's my generation's take. I love this. I love like all the.
I have the chills. Christmas. I'm so excited, guys.
So, like, I was really excited when I found out I was going to get to come on for this one because I already missed the, like, you guys, your first episode was Great Pumpkin, which was my, and is my favorite of the Peanuts specials. And this one is still one of, you guys were going through your yearly list. I don't really have that, but this I've seen, not every year, but pretty close. And
nice.
I don't know if I've done this long enough that I can say it's on the list, but I've recently made it a personal tradition to also watch the Boondocks Christmas episode, which is heavily inspired by this special.
You know what's funny? I know the writer for that. So I'm pretty sure Sean's wife, Angie, was EP on that show. I'm glad you mentioned that. And that's good because, I think we're trying to, I'd like to find some more modern specials because I feel like these were made in a capsule. And then, in the 80s, it was, the California Raisins.
Oh, God.
There's just a lot of stuff that, we kind of went off the rails. So it's nice to have those new specials. You guys, there's so much to get into with this. So let's just get started. Doing the research on Charles Schulz, everyone refers to him as Sparky. And that was the thing that blew me away. So I'm not going to do it today because I'm going to confuse our listeners. But no one called him Charles. He was called Sparky. And here's the interesting thing. Talk about things being manifested. His uncle sees him as an infant in a crib, an uncle who he doesn't see for 25 years after this moment, by the way, looks down and says, he's a little spark plug. He's like Sparky in the comic strip Barney Google, which I've never even heard of. Christian, have you ever heard of Barney Google, the comic strip?
Yes, but just in the way that I've heard of it, I can kind of visualize it. I feel like it's like a Beetle Bailey style, just visually.
Got it. Yeah, and maybe you can even look into it too and get us some info on it before the show's over. But Schulz later says he enjoys reading it. And, who would think that this would go on to become, arguably probably the greatest comic strip artist, I would say, Christian. Would that be accurate for comic strip? We have Kirby and we have Stan Lee,
For especially syndicated daily newspaper strips, everybody else was the goal was, if I could only do what Charles Schulz did.
Right.
Even long running, highly successful strips, that some of them still running. I mentioned Beetle Bailey, and High and Lois and so many of those other ones. But yeah, this is kind of the gold standard. And it's like, you know, you appreciate it as a kid. But then if you just read those strips as an adult, you're like, this is so dark. It's like in such a dark place.
And we'll get into it because it does. It really comes to light in the cartoons. So Charles, he himself thought he looked plain. And that's, you know, why one of the parts of Charlie Brown, he sees in himself, and that's why he wanted him designed in that way. He skips two grades in elementary school. And this really affects him because he's smaller and he's behind the rest of his classmates. So this forces him to turn inward and just to draw. But even when he gets to high school, the one thing he thinks could actually make him popular, which is the drawings, he gets accepted to the school newspaper and he thinks he's in, but then he finds out his works are never published. And these rejections both inspire his characters as being kind of like lovable losers, but then they also motivate him. Like he becomes very determined to be successful. He's too shy for college, so he goes to art instruction school after being in the Army. Thing about being in the Army is he got a lot of promotions in the Army, and this is the first time he was actually getting some confidence. And he said, this was the first time in my life I didn't feel like Charlie Brown, because I was actually getting ahead a little bit. Another tragedy strikes during the Army. He goes to visit his 48-year-old mom, and she says to him, you know, this is probably the last time you're ever going to see me.
Ouch.
And she ended up passing on of cancer. And it really affected him. And I think, you know, the more research I did on him, this kind of melancholy, stoic personality, I really feel like all these seeds get planted, you know, throughout his life. He names Charlie Brown after a real-life Charlie Brown person he knew. But he said it's based on him, and all the characters he say represent aside him. Interesting enough, that Charlie Brown did show up on, I think, What's My Line or To Tell the Truth, one of those shows, Christian, from back in the day, the real Charlie Brown showed up. That was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the other thing, too. He loves Walt Disney. He's a huge fan. Now, remember, he's a somewhat of a contemporary. It's not like us looking at Disney. This is during Disney's heyday, and he goes to apply for a job there. Now, he never meets Disney, but Disney's guys see his work and are like, this is crap. Don't hire him. But again, like all his rejections, he uses it as motivation. And I saw in an interview with Charlie Rose, he was like, one of the things he got a kick out of, he's like, yeah, I always think it's kind of funny that I have a star. My star in the Walk of Fame is right next to Walt Disney's. He's like, so I wonder what Walt thinks of that. And he said, listen, I think Disney's work is beautiful. Don't get me wrong. He's an iconic. He goes, but I would have made it better. And here's why. I would have made some of it funny. He goes, it's not funny. He goes, Walt wasn't a funny guy. So it's kind of interesting. When he publishes Peanuts, it's the editors that come up with the name Peanuts. He's like, I don't like that. He's like, I don't like the name. He goes, the name's depressing. It's a dumb name. It should be Charlie Brown, like Dennis the Menace. He's like, you know, editors are. They wanted it to be Peanuts. It's fine. It's interesting that the editors had that say, but yet he kept ownership of the strip. Obviously, he was a smart guy.
Yeah.
Like Disney, who kept ownership of Mickey Mouse and, you know, the rest is history. Like Charlie Brown's parents, Schultz's father was a barber and his mother was a housewife. Like Charlie Brown, Schultz often felt shy and withdrawn. In an interview with Charlie Rosen, which I just mentioned, I suppose there's a melancholy feeling in a lot of cartoonists, he said, because cartooning, like all other humor, comes from bad things happening. Like a lot of people say with art, you know. Schultz reportedly had a really smart dog when he was a boy, and although this dog was a pointer, not a beagle like Snoopy, family photos confirm a certain physical resemblance. References to Snoopy's brother Spike living outside of Needles, California, were influenced by the few years the Schultz family lived there. They lived in Needles to join other family members who had relocated to Minnesota to tend to an ill cousin. Schultz's inspiration for Charlie Brown's love of the little redheaded girl was Donna Mae Johnson, an art instruction accountant whom he fell in love with. When Schultz finally proposed to her in June of 1950, shortly after he had made his first contract to syndicate Charlie Brown, she turned him down and married another man. So again, this just keeps feeding this Charlie Brown narrative that he puts into Charlie Brown. Linus was named for his very good friend, Linus Mora. Peppermint Patty was inspired by Patricia Swanson, one of his cousins. Schultz devised the character's name when he saw peppermint candies in her house all the time. Schultz had a long association with ice sports. So you see that skating scene in the opening of this. He loved it so much that he bought and owned an ice arena, Redwood Empire Ice Arena. He opened it in 1969, 4 years after this show, had a snack bar in there called The Warm Puppy, of course, based on Snoopy. And then even to the end of his life, he would go there every morning for breakfast and watch the kids skate, which I thought was interesting, right? And yeah, also like, this is the things that makes me want to work hard and make more money. I need something like that. I need something random and ridiculous. You know, it's like a skating rink might be too much. I don't know. Maybe
something. I could see a latte stand though, maybe, Kev.
Yeah, maybe something like that. And just show up and sit there and talk to people. Anyway, everything he did in his day, he was always thinking of ideas for Charlie Brown. That never stopped literally until he passed on. He never considered himself an artist or that Charlie Brown is an art. Because art is something that goes on for generations. Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Right?
And how, you know, this has gone on for so many generations and clearly is going to continue to go on. And I think where Charlie Brown might be more with the boomers and the older people, Snoopy, I feel like Snoopy and Charlie Brown are the most popular of his characters, but I feel like Snoopy is almost Mickey Mouse, where he's, you're just going to continue to see him on other things. And so to me, it is art, but at the same time, he kind of talks out of both sides of his mouth, because he would go to modern art exhibits and he would see like a black swash of paint across a white canvas. He'd be like, wait, that's art, but my stuff isn't. Right. And then he would go out. He's like, and then I'd go see the Picassos and the Monets and say, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. I'm not doing art. So in 99, at 77, he has advanced colon cancer and he finally retires, even though he thought he'd be able to work into his late 80s. And so why Charlie Brown, he would never have Charlie Brown kick the football. He said, it would make Charlie Brown happy, but we are not always happy. And by the way, that's not funny. He was asked later, and I think, you know, could Charlie Brown ever kick the football? He said, oh, no, definitely not. I couldn't have Charlie Brown kick that football. That would be a terrible disservice to him after nearly half a century. But here's the thing. In December of 99, holding back tears, and I think he knew he was going to pass on, he recounted the moment when he signed his final strip, saying, all of a sudden, I thought, you know, that poor, poor kid, he never even got to kick the football. What a dirty trick. He never had a chance to kick the football. It's kind of interesting. Retires in 2000. And then Walter Cronkite narrates a special on him, which I watched and was very informative. Charles passes on the day after it airs. Peanuts Creed, he's consistently one of the highest earning dead celebrities. In a typical year, his heirs have been known to earn more in royalties than the heirs of John Lennon, Jimi Hendrix, and Elizabeth Taylor combined. And if that's not crazy enough, Charles himself is believed to have earned over $1 billion during the comic strip's unprecedented 50-year run.
He wrote Charlie Brown.
Right. Take that, Walt.
Right.
He wrote and drew every single comic himself. When he died, his will stated that no new Peanuts strip comics will ever be drawn by another cartoonist. And to date, his wishes have been honored. His heirs don't have to worry because they make about $32.5 million in income annually. And they've been doing that for a couple of decades. The family, I looked into it, they still own a very strong stake. And the middle son said in an interview that they would rather have Peanuts make $10 million a year and honor the father's integrity, honor it, create creatively, don't let any new stuff, strips be created, then make $100 million and lose all the input. So a little bit on Mr. Schultz that gives you, or Sparky, I say, or Mr. Schultz, as I promised I would say, is Charles Schultz. But with that, let's get into the history of this special. So Charlie Brown Christmas. Bill Mendelsohn is a documentary filmmaker who had pitched a documentary about Charles Schultz and the comic strip Charlie Brown. Because by this time in 1950, it was in 2,600 papers syndicated all over the country. So he's like, wow, we got to do a story on this. So they take it out and pitch it to everybody. And everyone's like, no, like it's a comic and he's depressing. And no, there's nothing here. So no one buys the documentary, but Coca-Cola has an ad exec named John Allen, who sees the 1965 Time magazine cover featuring Peanuts. And there's a mention of Mendelsohn and the work on the doc, etc. So he reaches out to him and he's like, listen, GE killed it the year before making Rudolph. What about Coca-Cola doing something with Charlie Brown? And so Mendelsohn blindly says, yeah, we're in. And so the guy from Coke goes, great, we'll buy it. We'll just, you know, come back to us with an outline. So Mendelsohn calls Schultz and goes, oh my God, like they by Monday, we have to give them an outline and a pitch, and they want it by Christmas. They want this special done by Christmas. So Mendelsohn and Schultz call in Bill Melendez, who's a great animator and director. And Melendez is brought in because there was actually animation for the Peanuts gang but not in a special. It was in a commercial for the Ford Falcon. So it was black and white. It was rough, but it gave you an idea. Because, you know, remember, like, I'm going to get into this too. There was a chore involved with taking a comic strip. And by the way, it's not animation's, you know, it's not as advanced as today. But to take it from a strip and now make it, you know, is it two-dimensional, Christian, or three-dimensional? You see, everyone, you would know. I mean, I think you're the smartest one on this. But when it goes to animation, is it two-dimensional or three-dimensional? Needless to say.
I think it's two because there's no depth.
There you go. So
this is
depth
2D,
is the third dimension.
Yeah. So you leave the 3D to James Cameron.
To Cameron, Mr. Cameron, yes. And yeah, he'll raise the bar for us, Christian.
Yes, he will.
South Park. So in one Thursday afternoon, they come up with the idea. And what I love about Melendez, there's such a love to this, to the end of all of their lives for one another. And Melendez, you know, and the other thing too, what I really admired is sometimes when you have someone who create the original IP, it takes other people to then pick that up and do something with it. We saw it, Rudolph, great song. But it was developed by Romeo Mueller, not even Rankin and Bass. I mean, you know, everyone had a hand in it, the looks and the aesthetic, but, you know, the actual story. What I love about this, and as Melendez said, it really was the abilities of Charles Schulz that were really sewn into this. And he said he is a tremendous creative and storyteller. And he said, and this is was in an interview probably 20 years ago, he said, I'm just in awe of him. And the three of them hammer out what this is going to look like. The cool thing is the three of them had never done a TV special before. So you would think they would have been all thumbs. CBS originally wanted this to be an hour-long special because they saw what Rudolph did and also Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, which someday I hope we'll cover. But it was Bill Melendez who said, to make it work, this needs to be 30 minutes. It's just, you got to trust me on this, guys. And by the way, once he did it, out comes Frosty, 30 minutes. Out comes the Grinch, 30 minutes, setting the stage for a lot of future specials to be that short. It's a 6-month production schedule, which if you know animation back then, that's unheard of. I can't even believe that, you know, they agreed to it, much less pulled it off. But interestingly enough, Melendez calls, not Rankin Bass, but Hanna-Barbera. So if you know your history, Hanna-Barbera dominated the cartoon world in the 60s and 70s. And there's some iconic stuff they created, but there's also some garbage they put out. I mean, and even the quality of animation was just terrible, which we've talked about on other shows. But when they called, he called for advice. Bill Hanna from Hanna-Barbera was like, yeah, no, there's really nothing I can offer you. I don't know what to tell you. He didn't give him any help at all. Kind of interesting, right? That's how revealing. The script only took a few weeks to complete. And after the original pitch to Coke, a few enhancements were made, including the Christmas tree, which was inspired by Mendelssohn's kid's love for the Hans Christian Andersen book, The Fir Tree, and Schulz's insistence that the tree be in line with the spirit of Charlie Brown. For music, they used the jazz soundtrack by Vince Guaraldi. And if you check out our other specials we covered, which was the Thanksgiving and the Halloween one, you know we went deep on Vince Guaraldi. But Vince loved the comic strip. And they all wanted this to be for adults and kids. And we talked about that, too. We were assuming that the network execs were thinking it's parents and kids, but also grandparents and kids. And this is jazz. Now, remember, like, it's the Beatles have come out now. It's 65. I mean, rock and roll is taking over, I would think, 30 and under. But probably 30 and older, I would say, is jazz and swing and, you know, big band and all that stuff was probably left over. So it's interesting that they put this in this, they decided to go for this. When he creates a Linus and Lucy song, he plays it over the phone for them. And Guaraldi plays a phone for them. They're like, oh my God, this is it. And what were you going to say?
I was just going to say one other funny thing that it was jazz that you just noted was that Schulz himself later went on to say that he personally thought jazz was awful.
I have that in here. Yeah, he did. He said, he goes, but thankfully I left the decisions to Mendelssohn, the director, because it worked. He's like, shortly after special air, he goes, I thought the jazz was awful. Here's the thing, though, about a couple fun things about the soundtrack. It's voted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 2007. In 2012, it's added to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry list of culturally, historically, or aesthetically important American recordings. So, of course, we have Linus and Lucy, which is the iconic Peanuts theme. But Christmas Time is Here, which, you know, we played at the opening. was just instrumental. But it's Mendelsohn, who's a producer and not even a writer or creator, when he finds out it needs lyrics, in 15 minutes, he comes up with all those lyrics. It's really cool. A little bit of controversy in the soundtrack that Anne found. According to several sources, Giraldi didn't really keep records of the session players. So decades later, there's a lot of dispute over who recorded what on the soundtrack. Getting back to the animation, Charles Schulz decides to take this big chance on Charlie Brown because other than in this commercial, he's never been animated. What he loved about Mendelsohn was how Mendelsohn was so respectful of Charles's work and his drawings and his animation. Again, this is usually rare because you bring in two artists. You've got the animator who's an artist, and you've got Charles an artist, and a lot of times they come in and go, no, 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 we got this, buddy. They give you the pat on the head. But he was like, he wanted to be super sensitive to what Charles's vision was. Kind of an interesting thing. Charlie Brown's giant head proved to be the hardest thing for the animators, especially when he was turning around. A funny note is that his arms, like many of the characters, are too short for him to scratch his head. Snoopy, on the other hand, turns out to be the easiest to animate. There are some missing scenes, which we'll get into. I'll just say it now. The opening, when Snoopy spins Charlie Brown and Linus around with his blanket, Charlie Brown crashes into the sign, which ends up having the opening that says A Charlie Brown Christmas. What got cut was Linus went into a sign that said Coca-Cola. But as time goes on, advertising standards get raised, and the government probably doesn't want sugar water being advertised that directly to children, and they have to edit it up, so it's not in there. Talking about the casting, Melendez only wants child actors for authenticity. They also wanted Charlie Brown to have a blah voice, that's a quote, and that's super hard to find, even though they want to have only amateurs, not even child actors, but just amateurs, and I'll get into why in a second. They have to cast Christopher Robbins, who is a child actor, but he is a professional.
Peter Robbins. Christopher Robbins hangs out with Winnie the Pooh.
He's with the Pooh. And I don't have the full name of the actor who plays Linus, but something Shea, but he's also a pro actor.
It's Christopher Shea.
Christopher Shea. That's where I screwed up. Sorry. Thank you, Ann.
No worries.
The rest of the people are amateurs. So as I said, in addition to only wanting child performers in lieu of adult actors, and by the way, like most animators back then, if they had a child, you typically use an adult. Why? Adult is more professional, more trained, and then there's legal reasons. You don't have restrictions on schooling. You don't have restrictions on hours. It's just much, much easier to work with adults. But they just said, no, we will lose the authenticity. Melendez further said, we're going to lose the authenticity if we have, quote, and he put this in quotes, Hollywood kids. If we have kids that are professionally child-trained actors, he's like, they're not going to be authentic. So everyone else other than Linus and Charlie Brown are outsiders and novices. Melendez actually sent tape recorders home with his employees for their kids to audition. Many of them came from this one Northern California neighborhood. Despite not being known, they taped the special in one day. And in an interview, Peter Robbins, who plays Charlie Brown, recalled that he remembers all the kids thinking that the script was really edgy and that the recording sessions were chaotic with kids running around. He went on to say how popular they all became at school after the show aired. A fun side note, the band Jefferson Airplane was recording their debut album in the studio next door, and they all came over to ask the kids for autographs. It's kind of interesting. I can imagine Grace Slick walking.
Well, Kev, I thought that same thing, and it was actually before Grace Slick was part of Jefferson Airplane.
Because, yeah. You know what? She just seems so salty, and I'm a big fan of hers. Yeah, I don't see her walking in, but then again, who knows? Maybe the darkness of Charlie Brown she would appreciate. I don't know.
Wait, did you say you're not a big fan of hers, Kev?
I'm a huge fan. No, oh, huge fan of Grace.
My mom's obsessed with her.
No, she's fantastic, but she's very salty, and she always was.
Yeah, she definitely strikes me as somebody that would pull the football away out on tour. Yeah.
And, even when you see her in the Woodstock, her eyes are half closed. She's in a whole other world. Like,
I think she was laser focused then, Kev.
Yes, we like to say, yes, on the Guy Friday or on the show, is that, yes, you're not on drugs, you are focused. Anyway, so Peter Robbins, as I mentioned, plays Charlie Brown, which is really cool since Charlie Brown had been his boyhood hero. He had followed the comic strip. And anytime you hear that famed "Argh," even episodes where he's not cast, that's his voice. So they kept bringing it back. So anytime the "Argh" comes out, it's the work of Peter Robbins. Now, sadly, he suffers from mental health issues and just died this past January. He committed suicide, which is really sad. And did you have any more information on that?
On his suicide or
oh, just any of just yeah. I mean, it was one of those things they probably just glossed over. I think they probably just glossed over it because you don't really want that attached to.
Well, I know he had been arrested a couple times. He had made death threats for like bodily injury or something, and stalking his former girlfriend. I think that happened around 2015 a couple of times, and then he did go to jail. And, you know, for threatening somebody, he lived in a mobile home park. So he had one of those sad, he had been working on an autobiography to Kev called Confessions of a Blockhead at the time of his death.
That would have been huge.
Yeah, which detailed it. And I know he had been making some public appearances at things like Comic-Con and things like that, signing autographs. And, you know, he'd show up with the big tat he had of Charlie Brown and Snoopy on his arm. But super sad. Yeah, he died last January or this past January. Yeah.
Sad to hear. Well, his
From bipolar.
His godmother was a Hollywood agent named Hazel McMillan, and she's the one who discovered Christopher Shaw, who played Linus. According to Mendelsohn, Christopher Shaw's slight lisp is what gave Linus that youthful sweetness, while his emotional reading gave him power and authority, which was the perfect blend for Linus. Kathy Steinberg, who played Sally, was only 6 and didn't know how to read, so the producers had to give her one line at a time to recite.
Adorable.
Right? They feed her and a lot of the younger actors half a line at a time, couple of words at a time, and that's why there's this kind of sing-songy pacing to how they speak. But one of the things that ends up working is that it creates kind of a distinct creative quality to these things, this quirkiness. But also, I think it helps you to buy into the authenticity of these being innocent children, because it does seem a little off rather than so eloquent or conversational. Bill Melendez, the animator, he does all the Snoopy voices, but he only did it as a temp measure. So a lot of times in filmmaking, we'll put things in as we call, just call, oh, it's just temp soundtrack. There's just a temp line here, a temp line there. And then you bring in the professional actor to do it. However, when they hear the execs or the powers that be hear it, they're like, oh, keep it. It's great. So that becomes Snoopy. Now, funny side note, the entire project almost gets scrapped by Coke. According to a USA Today interview with Mendelsohn, when the ad agency paid the boys an unexpected visit halfway through production, they saw that it looked terrible. The exec told him, listen, if I share my thoughts with Coke, they're going to pull the plug on this. Mendelsohn assured him that the charm of the characters would come through, and they were thankful because the exec never shared his opinion with Coke. Both the opening and closing theme, Hark the Herald's Angels Sing, were performed by children from the St. Paul's Episcopal Church Choir. The recording sessions often ran late into the night, which resulted in pissed off parents, some of whom refused to let their kids return. Again, it's always civilians. Hey, you can be part of this iconic thing that will last forever. Like, no, you need to go to bed. I'm tired. My mom was leading the charge. There was some dissension among the musical ranks as choir director Barry Minea demanded perfection from the kids. But this is where I love where you can tell the difference between mediocrities. So if you love the movie Amadeus, the Salieris of the world versus the Mozarts, because we know by now Mendelsohn and Gherardi, who did the music, were clearly geniuses and knew best. And they both disagreed with this guy. Like, no, we don't want perfection. We want them to be kids. We want them to sound like kids. So let them be slightly off key. All of it. Like, that's what's going to make it charming.
Right.
So, of course, it works. It's phenomenal. It's iconic. And 60 years later, we're still talking about this. So because of all that, the kids get paid $5 each for, you know, all the work they put in.
that's just daunting, right?
Yeah. And here's your $5 bill. And here's your $5 bill. They also did the final scene recording. They're the ones who say, Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown. It's a choir. But, you know, in all fairness, this is 1965. This is only the second special coming out. You know, television's kind of hitting its groove. And reruns, not really a thing. So I can see where, you know, showing up and getting $5, which, by the way, $5 back then probably was like, well, like, I don't know, a 20, you know, maybe even more.
Yeah, maybe more.
Maybe more, right? So everything is going smoothly until they see that Linus must read a line from the Bible. Or a passage from the Bible. Devout Christian Schultz would only do the special if it focused on the true meaning of Christmas. Now, Mendelssohn and Melendez fought him on this, but he was adamant that Linus would, in fact, read from the Bible. And Schultz threatens to walk away if the two don't agree with him. So his wife in later years, Schultz's wife, said, when he came back from the army, Charles was very lonely. His mother had died, like we said, and his dad was worried about him. So he brought him to their local pastor. He ends up going to church and being part of this youth group for 4 to 5 years. He's big in Bible study, and he ends up going to church 3 times a week. He claims to have read the Bible 3 times, and he even went on to teach Sunday school. He was always looking for what those passages really might have meant. And when he taught Sunday school, he would never tell people what to believe. God was very important to him, but in a very deep and mysterious way. Mendelssohn panics, which I understand why, even back then. He's like, this isn't an area we should get into. Other people said, it wasn't just about alienating people. It was about, wait, this is the Bible. It's sacred. And you can't put the Bible into some, you know, crass comic.
Right.
But Schultz was offended by that notion. He was like, the Bible isn't just for church. It's for everybody. So they all have to come around. And Linus ends up reading from the book of Luke, chapter 2 from the King James Bible. One critic notes that Linus' speech provides a much-needed antidote to commercialization and aggravation that Charlie Brown has been experiencing to that point. Charles Schultz's wife says, Linus is the philosophical one. He is the only one with wisdom to know the true meaning of Christmas. When Melendez and Henderson and Schultz see the final cut, they think they ruined Charlie Brown. The network sees it and agrees. They hate it. It didn't translate like they thought. And they had negative comments about the music, the jazz music. They thought the voices were totally amateur. And there's only one guy, an animator named Ed Levitt, who says, you know what? You're all crazy. This is going to run 100 years. They laugh in the guy's face. Here's the thing. They'd advertised it in TV Guide. They'd put so much money in advertising. They had to air it. So they said, okay, guys, we'll air it 1 year. We'll get rid of it. No problem. They air it. And what happens? They get a 50% share of the audience that night it airs, which is like freaking heard of, even by today. Forget it, but even back then, the late great Fred Silverman, who was the head of NBC, I saw an interview with him, and he admitted years later, I realize now, what the heck did I know against the mind of Charles Schultz?
Wow.
So CBS orders 15 years worth of future specials, then they get an Emmy and a Peabody Award, stunning the three. Charles Schultz was known to have said, Charlie Brown never wins anything, so we're even more shocked. And this is the second longest running special behind Rudolph. So that, let's take a little break, Kelsey. And when we come back, we will do the breakdown scene by scene of, what is it called, guys?
Charlie Brown Christmas.
Thank you. You know, guys, I try to test them, and this is what they do to me. Charlie Brown Christmas, Evan. Kelsey, it's Charlie Brown Christmas.
I was taking a note. I totally knew that.
Second most popular special of all time behind Rudolph. Just saying. Okay, you guys, that wraps up part one of A Charlie Brown Christmas. Tune in again for part two, where we'll cover the rest of this amazing, iconic special. Have your questions and comments ready, of course. If you haven't already done so, please go to Apple Podcasts to subscribe to the Christmas Specials We Love podcast. Check out our other shows. Give us that 5-star rating, and please leave a comment and tell friends about us. I feel like there's a big audience for this. We all do. That's why we're doing it. We put a lot of work into it. We ton of research. And I don't know, the best way for us to come back for season two is by getting your love and support. So please, please be so kind to do that. And again, tune into part two of A Charlie Brown Christmas.